Disc 7.
Remarkably enough, it was Washington who made the large-hearted conciliatory gesture after this altercation, and within an hour sent Tillman to see Hamilton. Tillman said that Washington regretted his fleeting temper and encouraged Hamilton to come and patch things up. Hamilton, now 26, had the colossal courage, or colossal cheek, to turn down Cole, the commander-in-chief. Where others were awed by the godlike Washington, Hamilton knew too well his mortal foibles. I requested Mr. Tillman to tell him that I had taken my resolution in a manner not to be revoked, that as a conversation could serve no other purpose than to produce explanations mutually disagreeable, though I certainly would not refuse an interview if he desired it, yet I should be happy if he would permit me to decline it. Washington reluctantly honored Hamilton's decision to leave his staff. Hamilton knew these events would shock Philip Schuyler, Washington's warm friend, who had been thrilled to have the general's aide-de-camp as his son-in-law. Hamilton told Schuyler that he wanted to command artillery or light infantry, but he knew a fuller explanation was required. He had not acted rashly, he insisted. He had long hated the personal dependence that accompanied his position and had found Washington to be much more temperamental than his exalted reputation allowed. Their working relationship had done violence to my feelings. Then Hamilton made a stunning revelation. Washington had wanted to be closer all along. It was Hamilton who had rebuffed him. For 3 years past, I have felt no friendship for him and have professed none. The truth is, our own dispositions are the opposites of each other, and the pride of my temper would not suffer me to profess what I did not feel. Indeed, when advances of this kind have been made to me on his part, they were received in a manner that showed at least I had no inclination to court them, and that I wished to stand rather upon a footing of military confidence than of private attachment. You are too good a judge of human nature not to be sensible how this conduct in me must have operated on a man to whom all the world is offering incense. The same day, Hamilton wrote to James McHenry in a more vindictive tone, showing that he was severely disillusioned with Washington and tired of feeling browbeaten. The great man and I have come to an open rupture. He shall, for once at least, repent his ill humor. Without a shadow of reason and on the slightest ground, he charged me in the most affrontive manner with treating him with disrespect. Hamilton acknowledged that Washington's popularity was necessary to the Patriots, and he promised to keep their rift a secret, but he had no intention of revising his decision. The rupture with Washington highlights Hamilton's egotism, outsized pride, and quick temper, and is perhaps the first of many curious lapses of judgment and timing that detracted from an otherwise stellar career. Washington had generously offered to make amends, but the hypersensitive young man was determined to teach the commander-in-chief a stern lesson in the midst of the American Revolution. Hamilton exhibited the recklessness of youth and a disquieting touch of folie de grandeur. On the other hand, Hamilton believed that he had been asked to sacrifice his military ambitions for too long, and that he had waited patiently for 4 years to make his mark. And he was only asking to risk his life for his country. If Hamilton were simply the brazen opportunist later portrayed by his enemies, he would never have risked this breach with the one man who would almost certainly lead the country if the revolution succeeded. Fortunately, Washington and Hamilton recognized that each had a vital role to play in the war and that this was too important to be threatened by petty annoyances. Despite their often conflicted feelings for each other, Washington remained unwaveringly loyal toward Hamilton, whom he saw as exceptionally able and intelligent, if sometimes errant. One senses a buried affection toward the younger man that he could seldom manifest openly. Where Hamilton had reservations about Washington as a general, he never underestimated his prudence, character, patriotism, and leadership qualities. In the last analysis, the durable bond formed between Hamilton and Washington during the Revolution was based less on personal intimacy than on shared experiences of danger and despair and common hopes for America's future. From the same situation, they had drawn the same conclusions. The need for a national army, for centralized power over the states, for a strong executive, and for national unity. Their political views, forged in the crucible of war, were to survive many subsequent attempts to drive them apart. Chapter 8. Glory. For a month after their feud, Washington and Hamilton performed their charade admirably, pretending that nothing had happened between them. Hamilton requisitioned two horses, one for him, one for his baggage, and rode off with Washington in early March to perform his last stint as interpreter in a conference with the Comte de Rochambeau and other French officers at Newport. On March 8th, Washington, Hamilton, and their French counterparts rode out on horseback for a sunset review of the French fleet, and that same day Hamilton drafted his last letter under Washington's signature. A few days later, Washington departed for what he called my dreary quarters at New Windsor, and Hamilton headed off to the Schuyler Mansion in Albany. One of the most brilliant, productive partnerships of the Revolution had ended. If Washington expected relief from Hamilton badgering him for an appointment, he soon learned otherwise. Hamilton was fully prepared to become a pest. In mid-April, he found quarters for himself and Eliza in a brick-and-stone Dutch dwelling at De Peyster's Point on the east bank of the Hudson, by no coincidence opposite Washington's headquarters at New Windsor. He even ordered a little boat which two people can manage so that he could scoot back and forth on short notice. No sooner was Hamilton unpacked than he told General Nathaniel Greene that he was scouting for anything that fortune may cast up, I mean in the military line. Hamilton seemed ubiquitous in New Windsor. One evening, a New England visitor, Jeremiah Smith, found himself discussing topical events with strangers at a local tavern. I was struck with the conversation, talents, and with the superior reasoning power of one who seemed to take the lead. It exceeded anything I had before heard, and even my conceptions. When the company retired, I found it was Colonel Hamilton I admired so much. On April 27th, the amazingly persistent young colonel addressed a formal letter to Washington, requesting a position in the vanguard force to be sent south. Reminding Washington of his earlier exploits as artillery captain, he noted, "I began in the line, and, had I continued there, I ought in justice to have been more advanced in rank than I now am." One can almost feel Washington growing hot under the collar in his reply. He was still dealing with extreme discontent in the ranks. Now he had to deal with Hamilton. "Your letter of this date has not a little embarrassed me," he replied, referring to the upheavals produced in the past when he had jumped junior officers above those of higher rank. Lest Hamilton suspect that his intransigence stemmed from their contretemps, Washington cautioned, "My principal concern arises from an apprehension that you will impute my refusal of your request to other motives than these I have expressed." While awaiting a military assignment, Hamilton, never idle, refined his thoughts about the financial emergency gripping the states. With the collapse of the continental currency, Congress conquered its fears of the centralized power that might be wielded by a finance minister. Power had begun to flow from congressional committees to individual department heads. For war, foreign relations, and finance, just as Hamilton had recommended to James Duane. General John Sullivan, now back in Congress, wanted to nominate Hamilton as the new superintendent of finance and sounded out Washington on his qualifications. However incredible it now seems, Washington confessed that he had never discussed finance with his aide, but he did volunteer, "This I can venture to advance from a thorough knowledge of him, that there are few men to be found of his age who has a more general knowledge than he possesses, and none whose soul is more firmly engaged in the cause, or who exceeds him in probity and sterling virtue." A glowing tribute from a man who had observed Hamilton at close range for 4 years. In the end, Sullivan withheld Hamilton's nomination due to overwhelming congressional support for Robert Morris, who took office in May 1781. A native of Liverpool, Morris had served in the Continental Congress and reluctantly signed the Declaration of Independence. He was an impressive-looking man with a wide, fleshy face, an ample paunch, and the sharp, shrewd gaze of a self-made merchant prince. He lived in a sumptuous Philadelphia mansion, tended by liveried servants, and was reputedly the richest man in town. He brought a somewhat mixed legacy to the new post. Lacking federal taxing power and a central bank, the Patriots had to rely on private credit, and Morris, more than anyone else, had sustained the cause by drawing on his own credit to pay troops and even government spies. On the other hand, critics had accused him of exploiting his government connections for personal gain. A lowly figure beside the august Morris, Hamilton wanted to establish his intellectual bona fides with the new superintendent of finance. Before writing to him, Hamilton brushed up on money matters and had Colonel Timothy Pickering send him some primers. David Hume's political discourses, tracts written by the English clergyman and polemicist Richard Price, and his all-purpose crib, Postlethwaite's Universal Dictionary of Trade and Commerce. On April 30, 1781, Hamilton sent a marathon letter to Morris. It runs to 31 printed pages that set forth a full-fledged system for shoring up American credit and creating a national bank. Portions of this interminable letter exist in Eliza's handwriting, complete with her faulty spelling, as if Hamilton's hand ached and he had to pass the pen to his bride at intervals. Hamilton started out sheepishly enough. "I pretend not to be an able financier. Neither have I had leisure or materials to make accurate calculations." Then he delivered a virtuoso performance as he asserted the need for financial reforms to complete the revolution. "'Tis by introducing order into our finances, by restoring public credit, not by gaining battles that we are finally to gain our object." Hamilton forecast a budget deficit of $4 to $5 million and doubted that foreign credit alone could trim it. His solution was a national bank. He traced the riches of Venice, Genoa, Hamburg, Holland, and England to their flourishing banks, which enhanced state power and facilitated private commerce. Once again, he plumbed the deep sources of British power. Where others saw only lofty ships and massed bodies of redcoats, Hamilton perceived a military establishment propped up by a vast fabric of credit. "'Tis by this alone she now menaces our independence." America, he argued, did not need to triumph decisively over the heavily taxed British. A war of attrition that eroded British credit would nicely do the trick. All the patriots had to do was plant doubts among Britain's creditors about the war's outcome. By stopping the progress of their conquests and reducing them to an unmeaning and disgraceful defensive, we destroy the national expectation of success from which the ministry draws their resources. This was an extremely subtle, sophisticated analysis for a young man immersed in wartime details for 4 years. America could defeat the British in the bond market more readily than on the battlefield. Hamilton had developed a fine appreciation of English institutions while fighting for freedom from England. In the letter's finale, he contended that America should imitate British methods and exploit the power of borrowing. "A national debt, if it is not excessive, will be to us a national blessing. It will be powerful cement of our union." Clearly, Hamilton was in training to superintend American finance someday. In late May, Morris sent him a flattering reply, informing him that many of his opinions tallied precisely with his own. Congress had just approved Morris's plan for the Bank of North America, a merchant bank that he hoped would be expanded after the war to encourage commerce. This exchange of letters initiated an important friendship. During the next few years, Hamilton and Morris were kindred spirits in their efforts to establish American finance on a sound, efficient basis. Hamilton continued to stew about the Articles of Confederation, which had been ratified belatedly by the last state on February 27, 1781. Hamilton thought this loose framework a prescription for rigor mortis. There was no federal judiciary, no guiding executive, no national taxing power, and no direct power over people as individuals, only as citizens of the states. In Congress, each state had one vote, and 9 of the 13 states had to concur to take significant actions. The Articles of Confederation promised little more than a fragile alliance of 13 miniature republics. Hamilton had already warned that if the ramshackle Confederacy fostered the illusion that Congress had sufficient power, it would be an evil, for it is unequal to the exigencies of the war or to the preservation of the Union hereafter. Again, Hamilton appealed for a convention to bring forth a more durable government. That the 13 states would someday coalesce into a single country was far from a foregone conclusion. Indeed, the states had hampered many crucial war measures, such as long-term enlistments, from fear that their troops might shed their home state allegiances. People continued to identify their states as their countries, and most outside the military had never traveled more than a day's journey from their homes. But the Revolution itself, especially the Continental Army, had been a potent instrument for fusing the states together and forging an American character. Speaking of the effect that the fighting had on him, John Marshall probably spoke for many soldiers when he said, I was confirmed in the habit of considering America as my country and Congress as my government. During the war, a sense of national unity seeped imperceptibly into the minds of many American diplomats, administrators, congressmen, and above all, the nucleus of officers gathered around Washington. These men had gotten many dismaying glimpses of the shortcomings of the Articles of Confederation, and many later emerged as confirmed advocates of a tight-knit union of the states. As a member of Washington's family, Hamilton had stumbled upon the crowning enterprise of his life, the creation of a powerful new country. By dint of his youth, foreign birth, and cosmopolitan outlook, he was spared pre-war entanglements in provincial state politics, making him a natural spokesman for a new American nationalism. As soon as he left Washington's staff, he began to convert his private opinions into cogently reasoned newspaper editorials. In July and August 1781, he published a quartet of essays in the New York Packet entitled The Continentalist that were signed A.B., the same initials as in the letter written to Sir Henry Clinton proposing the trade of Major André for Benedict Arnold. These four articles seem spirited precursors to the Federalist Papers. Instead of carping at problems in random fashion, Hamilton delivered a systematic critique of the current political structure. He introduced a critical theme, that the dynamics of revolutions differed from those of peacetime governance. The post-war world had to be infused with a new spirit, respectful of authority, or anarchy would reign. An extreme jealousy of power is the attendant on all popular revolutions and has seldom been without its evils. It is to this source we are to trace many of the fatal mistakes which have so deeply endangered the common cause, particularly that defect which will be the object of these remarks, a want of power in Congress. Where revolutions by their nature resisted excess government power, the opposite situation could be equally hazardous. As too much power leads to despotism, too little leads to anarchy, and both, eventually, to the ruin of the people. Unless the central government's hand was strengthened, asserted Hamilton, the states would amass progressively more power until the Union disintegrated into secessionist movements, smaller confederacies, or civil war. He especially feared that populist states would indulge in separatist designs and take advantage of commercial rivalries or boundaries disputes as pretexts to wage war against smaller states. To avert the situation, Hamilton listed a litany of powers that Congress needed to strengthen the Union, especially the powers to regulate trade, levy enforceable taxes on land and individuals, and appoint military officers of every rank. Only unity could wring from skittish foreign creditors the large loans necessary to conclude the war. In closing, Hamilton applauded the national bank proposed by Morris, which would wed the interest of the moneyed men with the resources of government. This alliance would help to prop up a shaky government. Hamilton's life was to be all of a piece, and the kernel of many of his later theories first germinated in these essays. His views did not change greatly over time so much as expand in richness, depth, and scope. Vernon Parrington later observed of Hamilton, singularly precocious, he matured early. Before his 25th year, he seems to have developed every main principle of his political and economic philosophy, and thereafter he never hesitated or swerved from his path. To a peculiar extent, his mind was already focused on the problems that were to dominate the post-war period. During the spring and early summer of 1781, Hamilton never slackened in his efforts to wrest a field command from Washington. And yet he refused to admit his bulldog tenacity. In May, he told Washington, with no apparent irony, "I am incapable of wishing to obtain any object by importunity." Eliza worried about his safety if he received a field command, while Sister Angelica entered into Hamilton's elaborate ambitions. When Angelica's husband, John Barker Church, got wind of rumors that Hamilton might obtain an appointment, he coyly informed his brother-in-law that a certain lady, who has not yet made her appearance this morning, is very anxious for your happiness and glory. In early July, still panting for a combat role, Hamilton tempted fate by sending Washington a letter containing his commission, thus tacitly threatening to resign if he didn't get his desired command. It says much about Washington's high esteem for Hamilton that instead of bridling at this effrontery, he sent Tench Tillman to him in an accommodating spirit. This morning Tillman came to me in his, Washington's, name, pressed me to retain my commission with an assurance that he would endeavor by all means to give me a command, Hamilton told Eliza, who had gone to stay with her family in Albany. Though I know my Betsy would be happy to hear I had rejected this proposal, it is a pleasure my reputation would not permit me to afford her. Finally, on July 31st, Hamilton succeeded in his long-standing quest when he received command of a New York light infantry battalion and chose Nicholas Fish, his King's College classmate, as his second in command. With the war nearing its climax, Hamilton knew that Washington had vouchsafed one last coveted chance for battlefield laurels. If Eliza brooded about her husband's well-being, Hamilton returned the favor, especially after learning in late spring that Eliza was pregnant with their first child. The New York frontier around Albany had been plundered repeatedly by Tory and Indian raids. In one infamous massacre in 1778, they had mutilated and dismembered 32 patriots, and General Schuyler bemoaned to his son-in-law in May 1781 that the area was one general scene of ruin and desolation. Schuyler himself was especially vulnerable. He had overseen a spy network with such efficiency that the British were plotting to kidnap him at home, as he learned that spring, and he made special arrangements to have an Albany guard hasten to his aid in case of emergency. On August 7th, about 20 Tories and Indians barged into the Schuyler mansion, overpowered the sleeping guards, seized weapons in the cellar, and surrounded the house. Angelica had removed some weapons to the cellar when she found her little boy playing with them. General Schuyler retreated to an upstairs bedroom where, using a prearranged signal, he fired his pistol out the window to summon help. Mrs. Schuyler and her daughters were so horrified, some hanging on General Schuyler's arms and others embracing his knees in the most distressing terror and uncertainty, reported one eyewitness, that the general was trapped by his clinging family. Then the women remembered that Mrs. Schuyler's infant daughter Catherine had been left in a cradle by the front door. Since both Eliza and Angelica were pregnant, Sister Peggy crept downstairs to retrieve the endangered child. The leader of the raiding party barred her way with a musket. "Wench, wench, where is your master?" he demanded. "Gone to alarm the town," the cool-headed Peggy said. The intruder, fearing that Schuyler would return with troops, fled in alarm. Legend maintains that one Indian hurled a tomahawk at Peggy's head as she trotted up the stairs with the baby in her arms. To this day, the mahogany banister bears what are thought to be scars from the blade. Hamilton was shocked by the news. "I have received, my beloved Betsy, your letter informing me of the happy escape of your father. He showed an admirable presence of mind. My heart has felt all the horror and anguish attached to the idea of your being yourself and seeing your father in the power of ruffians." Until early August, Washington had been planning a siege of New York City, so Hamilton did not expect to be too distant from Eliza during her pregnancy. Then in mid-August, Washington learned that the Comte de Grasse, admiral of the French fleet in the West Indies, planned to sail for Chesapeake Bay. This sensational piece of news dovetailed with another that promised a decisive military action. Lafayette informed him that General Cornwallis was now entrenched at Yorktown, surrounded by water on three sides. This made the spot, from one perspective, a perfect fortress, and from another, a perfect trap. Washington had wanted to deal the coup de grace to the British in New York and recoup his earlier losses by reclaiming Manhattan and Long Island. The Comte de Rochambeau dashed this plan, citing problems posed by shallow waters outside New York Harbor and the British fortifications on Manhattan. So with some reluctance, Washington agreed to hazard all by moving additional men to the Chesapeake to link up with Lafayette and de Grasse's fleet in choking off Cornwallis's army. In late August, Hamilton informed Eliza indiscreetly that he and part of the army would be moving to Virginia. The move was still a military secret. He refused to quit his troops or request a leave to see his bride. "I must go without seeing you," he wrote 3 days after the New York troops began to march south. "I must go without embracing you. Alas, I must go." He remained, however, the dreamy newlywed. "I am more greedy of your love than a miser of his gold," he continued. It is the food of my hopes, the object of my wishes, the only enjoyment of my life. On September 6th, he divulged to Eliza the army's destination. Tomorrow we embark for Yorktown, and sounded confident of victory. In a poetic conceit that he often played with but never acted upon, he toyed with abandoning worldly pursuits to luxuriate in her company. Every day confirms me in the intention of renouncing public life and devoting myself wholly to you. Let others waste their time and their tranquility in a vain pursuit of power and glory. Be it my object to be happy in a quiet retreat with my better angel. Like other founders and Enlightenment politicians, Hamilton could never quite admit the depth of his ambition, lest it cast doubts on his revolutionary purity. In the midst of such rarefied goals as freedom and independence, who could admit to baser motives or any thoughts of personal gain? Washington had also balked at the Yorktown plan because he wondered how could he move his hungry, bedraggled troops long distances along muddy roads without advertising his intentions to the British. He solved this dilemma ingeniously, marching foot soldiers southward in parallel lines at staggered intervals to mislead the enemy about his intentions. Washington knew that he had a singular chance to strike a mortal blow against the British if he could coordinate the massive movements of men and ships. With unerring precision, he guided his 2,000 men and de Rochambeau's 4,000 so they would rendezvous in Virginia with 29 large ships of the line and 3,000 troops brought from the West Indies by Admiral de Grasse, supplemented by 7,000 Americans already in place under Lafayette. To Washington's jubilation, Admiral de Grasse showed up even before he did, a fact that made the reserved Washington literally jump for joy. When Washington boarded the Admiral's flagship, the Ville de Paris, a resplendent triple-decker with 120 guns, the Frenchman teased his towering American counterpart by calling him Mon cher petit général. In late September, Hamilton and his light infantry reached Williamsburg, the staging area for the Yorktown siege, where he enjoyed an exuberant reunion with a trio of old friends, Lafayette, then convalescing from malaria, John Laurens, just back from Paris with arms, ammunition, and a large French subsidy negotiated by Benjamin Franklin, and Lieutenant Colonel Francis Barber, his teacher from Elizabethtown days, who had been wounded at Monmouth and had fought valiantly throughout the war. On September 28th, Hamilton and his men trudged toward Yorktown, through deep woods that opened intermittently to reveal fields of corn and tobacco. When they arrived the next day, the siege had just commenced. Dug in on high ground, Cornwallis had been throwing up earthwork redoubts since early August, employing thousands of slaves who had defected to the British lines in expectation of earning their freedom. In all, he built 10 outlying defensive strongholds. Two would have caught the attention of Hamilton and his men at once. Numbers 9 and 10 stood closer to Allied troops than the others. It was here that Hamilton was finally to have his oft-postponed appointment with military glory. By October 6th, expert French engineers, aided by fine autumnal weather, began to carve out two deep parallel trenches about 600 yards from the British lines to seal Cornwallis and his famished, fever-racked men inside a trap. Military custom dictated a small celebration when the first trench was completed. Hamilton and his men were drafted for this honor and had no sooner disappeared into the long ditch amid swirling flags and thudding drums than the British let loose cannon fire. With a bit of completely unnecessary bravado, Hamilton issued an outlandish order. Perhaps knowing his men were beyond the range of small arms fire, he brought them out of the trench and onto exposed ground, where he put them through parade ground drills before the flabbergasted British. Luckily, the British didn't, or couldn't, mow them down. Of this irresponsible performance, one subordinate, Captain James Duncan, wrote in his diary, "Colonel Hamilton gave these orders, and, although I esteem him one of the first officers in the American army, must beg in this instance to think he wantonly exposed the lives of his men." By October 9th, the Allies began to bombard Cornwallis, with Washington himself touching off the first volley of cannon fire. Day and night, the cannonade exploded with such unrelenting fury that one lieutenant in the Royal Navy said, "It seemed as though the heavens should split." As the din grew almost unendurable, this British officer saw men lying nearly everywhere who were mortally wounded, whose heads, arms, and legs had been shot off. The distressing cries of the wounded and the lamentable suffering of the inhabitants, whose dwellings were chiefly in flames, added to an omnipresent sense of danger. By October 14th, the second parallel trench had been nearly completed, and only redoubts 9 and 10 needed to be overrun to complete it. These defenses bristled with sharpened trees poised to impale any invading troops. Addressing his men on horseback, Washington explained that the siege could not advance farther unless these two positions were taken by simultaneous bayonet attacks. Any delay would only enhance the likelihood that British rescue vessels might arrive in time to evacuate Cornwallis. Washington fraternally decided that one redoubt would be taken by a light infantry brigade commanded by the French and the other by the Continental Army under Lafayette. Lafayette tapped his personal aide, Jean-Joseph Chevalier de Jemmaine, to spearhead the charge, a selection that scarcely produced the bipartisan Franco-American amity intended by Washington. For Hamilton, who had envisioned this moment since his clerkship on St. Croix, Lafayette's choice of Jemmaine threatened to rob him of his last great chance to fight. Mustering all his fire and eloquence, he pleaded again with Washington by letter, pointing out that he had seniority over Jemmaine and that as officer of the day projected for the attack, he enjoyed priority. At this point, Washington either decided that Hamilton was an implacable force or that Jemmaine was too French to represent the Continental Army. Nicholas Fish shared a tent with Hamilton at Yorktown and remembered his friend bursting in gleefully after visiting Washington. "We have it," Hamilton shouted. "We have it." Hamilton was to command three battalions led by Jemmaine, Fish, and Lawrence. Hamilton's appointment at Yorktown has been shadowed by scurrilous gossip, mostly peddled by John Adams. Years later, Adams told his friend Benjamin Rush that Hamilton blackmailed Washington to get the command. Hamilton flew into a violent passion and demanded the command of the party for himself and declared, if he had it not, he would expose General Washington's conduct in a pamphlet. It is true that Hamilton sometimes spoke disparagingly about Washington's military abilities, but only in private. It is inconceivable that Hamilton would have resorted to threats against Washington, or that the latter would have yielded to them, or that their relationship would have survived such extortion for another 18 years of the most intimate collaboration. A portrait by Alonzo Chapel of Hamilton at the Yorktown siege presents him in an unexpected pose. He stands by a cannon in a plumed hat, sunk in thought, his arms folded and his eyes downcast. More the man of thought than of action, he gives no clue to the theatrics he was shortly to perform in the frenzy of battle. 2 days before exposing himself to enemy fire, Hamilton wrote to Eliza, now 5 months pregnant, a light-hearted letter that attempted to assuage her worries. He chided her for not matching his output of 20 letters in 7 weeks, and said she could make amends only one way. "You shall engage shortly to present me with a boy. You will ask me if a girl will not answer the purpose. By no means. I fear, with all the mother's charms, she may inherit the caprices of her father, and then she will enslave, tantalize, and plague one half the sex." To expedite the siege, Washington decided to seize redoubts 9 and 10 with bayonets instead of pounding them slowly into submission with cannon. French soldiers were to overrun the redoubt on the left while Hamilton's light infantry stormed the one on the right. After nightfall on October 14th, the Allies fired several consecutive shells in the air that brilliantly illuminated the sky. Hamilton and his men then rose from their trenches and raced with fixed bayonets toward Redoubt 10. Displaying astonishing speed, Hamilton and his men sprinted across a quarter mile of landscape, pocked and rutted from exploding shells. As a mark of soldierly pride, they had unloaded their guns to take the position with bayonets alone. Dodging heavy fire, they let out war whoops that startled their enemies. "They made such a terrible yell and loud cheering," said one Hessian soldier, "that one believed the whole wild hunt had broken out." Hamilton and his men ran so fast that they almost overtook the sappers, who were snapping off the edges of the sharpened tree branches and opening a breach through which the infantry rushed. Hamilton, hopping on the shoulder of a kneeling soldier, sprang onto the enemy parapet and summoned his men to follow. Their password was Rochambeau. A good one, said one American, because it sounds like Rochambeau's when pronounced quick. Once inside the fallen redoubt, Hamilton assembled his men quickly in formation. The whole operation had consumed fewer than 10 minutes. Hamilton had accomplished the capture handily, suffering relatively few casualties. The French brigade met stiffer resistance and suffered heavy losses. Hamilton was exemplary in his treatment of the enemy. Some of his men clamored for revenge against the captives, and one captain was about to run a British officer through the chest with a bayonet when Hamilton interceded to prevent any bloodshed. He later reported proudly, "Incapable of imitating examples of barbarity and forgetting recent provocations, the soldiers spared every man who ceased to resist." Besides showing humanity, Hamilton, in his leniency toward his prisoners, expressed his belief that wars, like duels, were honorable rituals, conducted by gentlemen according to sacred and immutable rules. The taking of the two redoubts enabled the Allied troops to outfit them with howitzers and finish the second parallel trench. As Hamilton and Henry Knox inspected the captured redoubt, they engaged in an academic controversy that afforded a humorous interlude. Washington had given orders that whenever soldiers spotted a shell, they should exclaim, "A shell!" Hamilton didn't think this order soldierly, whereas Knox thought it reflected Washington's prudent regard for his men's welfare. Amid this learned dispute, two enemy shells burst inside the redoubt. The soldiers present screamed, "A shell! A shell!" Instinctively, Hamilton sought shelter by grabbing the obese Knox, who had to wrestle him off. "Now, what do you think, Mr. Hamilton, about crying shell?" Knox protested. "But let me tell you not to make a breastwork of me again." Completion of the second trench snuffed out the last remnants of resistance among the British. Cornwallis had grown so desperate that he infected blacks with smallpox and forced them to wander toward enemy lines in an attempt to sicken the opposing forces. He knew that he lay in grave peril and wrote to Sir Henry Clinton, "My situation now becomes critical. We shall soon be exposed to an assault in ruined works, in a bad position, and with weakened numbers." After dark on October 16th, Cornwallis tried to evacuate his men by sea, but a drenching midnight storm made that impossible. All the while, the Allied artillery pummeled his position without mercy. On the warm morning of October 17th, a red-coated drummer boy appeared on the parapet, followed by an officer flapping a white handkerchief. The guns fell silent. Cornwallis had surrendered. "Tomorrow, Cornwallis and his army are ours," Hamilton rejoiced to Eliza on October 18th. "In 2 days after, I shall in all probability set out for Albany, and I hope to embrace you in 3 weeks from this time." Tens of thousands of onlookers gaped in amazement as the shattered British troops marched out of Yorktown and, to the tune of an old English ballad, "The World Turned Upside Down," moved between parallel rows of handsomely outfitted French soldiers and battered, ragged American troops. Hamilton calmly surveyed the final ceremony on horseback. His chat with many defeated British soldiers left him with a bitter aftertaste. To the Vicomte de Noailles, he confided, "I have seen that army so haughty in its success, and I observed every sign of mortification with pleasure." He was outraged by the British soldiers' taunts of future revenge against America. "Cruel in its vengeance, England will not believe that every project of conquest in America is vain." Indeed, although the lopsided Franco-American victory at Yorktown put the eventual outcome of the war beyond dispute, the British still occupied New York City, fighting persisted in the West Indies, and the war was to drag on for another 2 years. Within a week, Colonel Hamilton had sped off to join Eliza in Albany, riding so hard that he exhausted his horses and had to hire another pair. He was ill and fatigued from more than 5 years of fighting and spent much of the next 2 months recovering in bed. On January 22, 1782, Eliza rewarded him with a son, christened Philip in tribute to her father. "Mrs. Hamilton has given me a fine boy," Hamilton wrote jovially to the Vicomte de Noailles, whose birth, as you may imagine, was attended with all the omens of future greatness. In case further heavy fighting should flare up, Hamilton did not resign from the army right away and got a furlough from Washington. Only after visiting Washington in Philadelphia in March did Hamilton retire. He preserved his rank, yet surrendered all claim to the compensations attached to my military station during the war or afterwards. Among other things, Hamilton renounced a pension that ultimately was to equal 5 years of full pay. His motives were certainly laudable. He wanted to remove the slightest conflict of interest as the army was demobilized and its members' future compensation debated. But his widow and offspring were to one day rue his decision and work hard to reverse it. Because of his valiant performance at Yorktown, Hamilton became a certified hero. Yet it rankled that Congress never honored his bravery as Louis XVI did the heroism of the Frenchman who seized the other redoubt. Though he lacked official recognition, Hamilton gained something infinitely more precious for his political future: legendary status. At Yorktown, Hamilton established his image as a romantic, death-defying young officer, gallantly streaking toward the ramparts. Take away that battle, and Hamilton would have gone down as the most prestigious of Washington's aides, but not a hero. And without that cachet, he might never have been appointed a major general later on. The American Revolution transformed Hamilton from an insecure outsider to a consummate insider who was married to the daughter of General Schuyler and stood on easy terms with the leaders of the Continental Army. In a eulogy that he later delivered for General Nathanael Greene, Hamilton talked about the personal opportunities that accompany revolutions. He said of them that it has very properly been ranked not among the least of the advantages which compensate for the evils they produce, that they serve to bring to light talents and virtues which might otherwise have languished in obscurity or only shot forth a few scattered and wandering rays. Who could doubt that the comment had an autobiographical ring? Chapter 9, Raging Billows. With the British still clinging to New York City after Yorktown, Hamilton adopted the Schuyler Mansion in Albany as his temporary home for the next 2 years. His lifelong wanderings ended as he formally became a citizen of New York State in May 1782. As he rocked the cradle and dandled the infant Philip, the 27-year-old war veteran projected the image of a contented paterfamilias. "You cannot imagine how entirely domestic I am growing," he told ex-Washington aide Richard Kidder Meade. In a letter veined with whimsy, Hamilton described Philip at 7 months. "It is agreed on all hands that he is handsome, his features are good, his eye is not only sprightly and expressive, but it is full of benignity. His attitude in sitting is by connoisseurs esteemed graceful, and he has a method of waving his hand that announces the future orator. He stands, however, rather awkwardly, and his legs have not all the delicate slimness of his father's. If he has any fault in manners, he laughs too much." Hamilton so savored this unaccustomed domestic role that he informed Meade, "I lose all taste for the pursuits of ambition. I sigh for nothing but the company of my wife and my baby." Meade must have known this was poppycock and that Hamilton's career would move forward with its own furious inner propulsion. He had lost time in the Caribbean, plus another 5 years in the Revolution, so as he resumed the legal studies suspended at King's, he wanted to adhere to a speeded-up timetable. For Hamilton, the law arose as the shortest route to political power. The profession claimed 34 delegates at the Constitutional Convention, and it would enable him to make a tolerable, even lucrative living. Ordinarily, the New York Supreme Court stipulated that would-be lawyers serve a 3-year apprenticeship before appearing in court. However, responding to a petition from Aaron Burr that January, the rule was temporarily waived for returning veterans who had begun their law studies before the war. Having waded through the tomes of all the major legal sages at King's, Hamilton qualified for this exemption and set about mastering the law in short order. Unlike other aspiring lawyers of the time, Hamilton declined to clerk under a practicing attorney and planned to instruct himself. After serving Washington, he probably did not wish to be subservient to another boss and could not bear the prospect of copying out legal documents for some self-styled mentor. He had access to the superlative law library in Albany owned by his friend James Duane, its shelves stocked with treatises on British law, which closely paralleled New York law. In this state, our judicial establishments resemble more nearly than in any other those of Great Britain, Hamilton later wrote in Federalist No. 83. For Hamilton and other New York law students, British thought crept into their minds in this subliminal fashion and exerted a conservative, Anglophile influence. Particularly influential were Sir William Blackstone's Commentaries, first published in America 10 years earlier, which endowed British law with a more systematic coherence. Forrest MacDonald has observed, Blackstone taught Hamilton a reverential enthusiasm for the law itself. Moreover, the law, as Blackstone spelled it out, resolved once and for all the tension Hamilton had felt between liberty and law. In that era, law students often cobbled together workbooks that arranged legal precedents, statutes, and procedures by category. John Marshall kept a digest that covered 238 manuscript pages, spanning more than 70 topics. He drew on it extensively in his practice. Hamilton prepared his own manual, entitled Practical Proceedings in the Supreme Court of the State of New York. This compendium of 177 manuscript pages and 38 topics is the earliest surviving treatise that captures New York law as it shifted away from British and colonial models. Hamilton did not just transcribe dry extracts. He poked fun at legal pretensions. In one place, he said facetiously that the courts had lately acquired some faint idea that the end of suits at law is to investigate the merits of the cause and not to get entangled in the nets of technical terms. Later, the source of famous proclamations about the law's majesty, Hamilton could also be quite waspish about his chosen profession, telling Lafayette that he was busy rocking the cradle and studying the art of fleecing my neighbors. Practical Proceedings was so expertly done, its copious information so rigorously pigeonholed, that it was copied by hand and circulated among New York law students for years until it was superseded by William Witch's 1794 manual, New York Supreme Court Practice, which was itself based in part on Hamilton's outline. Even then, some attorneys continued to prefer Hamilton's seminal version. Hamilton raced through his legal studies with quicksilver speed. By July, just 6 months after starting his self-education, he passed the bar exam and was licensed as an attorney who could prepare cases before the New York State Supreme Court. In October, he further qualified as a counselor who could argue cases, a status akin to an English barrister. He had to sign an allegiance oath, which showed the extent to which states held sovereign sway under the Articles of Confederation. I renounce all allegiance to the King of Great Britain, and will bear true faith and allegiance to the state of New York as a free and independent state. In acquiring these credentials, Hamilton lagged 6 months behind Aaron Burr, who had opened an Albany law office in July 1782. Aside from having sacrificed time to warfare, both young men were rushing to set up practices because it was widely known that patriotic lawyers would inherit the lion's share of legal work after the peace. This had been confirmed in November 1781 when the New York legislature enacted a law barring Tory lawyers from state courts, a certain bonanza for Republican attorneys. Even though Hamilton was to hotly contest anti-Tory bias, he and other young attorneys who had sided with the Patriots profited from it during the more than 4 years that the law stayed in effect. There is little doubt that Hamilton and Burr socialized a good deal in Albany. While Hamilton was still at Yorktown, Burr had shown up on the Schuyler doorstep with a letter of introduction from General Alexander McDougall. This will be handed to you by Lieutenant Colonel Burr, who goes to Albany to solicit a license in our courts. It was probably at this point that a pregnant Eliza first smiled and shook hands with her husband's future executioner. Hamilton's old classmate Robert Troop was studying for the bar in Albany with his friend Burr, and the two were licensed at the same time. During the summer of 1782, Troop resided at the Schuyler Mansion, helping Hamilton with whatever legal tutoring he needed. Thus, from the outset of their careers, Hamilton and Burr were thrust into close proximity and a competitive situation. Both were short and handsome, witty and debonair, and fatally attractive to women. Both young colonels had the self-possession of military men, liked to flaunt their titles, and seemed cut out to assume distinguished places at the New York bar. Yet in the political sphere, Burr already trailed his upstart acquaintance, who was now a hero of Yorktown and basked in the reflected aura of General Washington. Hamilton also inhabited the splendid Schuyler Mansion, while Burr settled for a frugal life until he could build up a legal clientele. That July, Burr married Theodosia Prevost, the confidant of Peggy Shippen Arnold in the Dutch Reformed Church frequented by the Schuylers. Theodosia's husband, a British officer, had died in Jamaica the previous fall. They had a daughter, also named Theodosia, the following year. The elder Theodosia was 10 years older than Burr and was never mistaken for a beauty, but she was charming, pleasant, and conversant in both French and English literature. As much as any man of his day, Burr appreciated smart, accomplished women, which made his later roguish antics all the more inexplicable to admirers. However impressive it was that Hamilton could compress 3 years of legal training into 9 months, he juggled several other balls at once. After Yorktown, he wrote 2 more installments of the Continentalist essays, which he then lost or misplaced. He has lately recovered them, the New York Packet informed readers in April 1782, in introducing The Continentalist No. 5. The paper said he had published the essays more to finish the development of his plan than from any hope that the temper of the times will adopt his ideas. In a sweeping historical tour, Hamilton showed how the English government had fostered trade starting in the reign of Queen Elizabeth, and how Louis Colbert had accomplished the like as Louis XVI's finance minister. He alluded to David Hume's essays in endorsing government guidance of trade, which he denied was self-regulating and self-correcting. Previewing his treasury tenure, he advocated duties on imported goods as America's best form of revenue. For a nation still fighting a revolution over unjust duties on tea and other imports, this was, to put it mildly, a loaded topic. To those who feared oppressive taxes, Hamilton made an argument that anticipated supply-side economics of the late 20th century, saying that officials can have no temptation to abuse this power because the motive of revenue will check its own extremes. Experience has shown that moderate duties are more productive than high ones. At the time, many states were loath to transfer control over their own import duties to Congress, and Hamilton feared that the resulting economic rivalries would threaten political unity. His qualms were shared by Robert Morris, who sketched the broad contours of a program, establishing a national bank, funding the war debt, and ending inflation, that was the forerunner of Hamilton's work as Treasury Secretary. To strengthen the central government, Morris decided to appoint a tax receiver in each state who would be free from dependence on local officials. On May 2, 1782, he asked Hamilton to become receiver of continental taxes for New York. As an inducement, he assured Hamilton that he could pocket 0.25% of any monies collected. Hamilton, feeling harried, turned him down flat. "Time is so precious to me that I could not put myself in the way of any interruptions unless for an object of consequence to the public or to myself," he replied. Hamilton may have suspected that with 5 New York counties still in enemy hands, the job would not be that remunerative. In early June, Morris sweetened the pot by guaranteeing Hamilton a percentage of the money owed, not just collected. This evidently persuaded Hamilton to accept the offer, and he further volunteered to lobby the state legislature for Morris's tax measures. Whether the self-taught Hamilton knew it or not, and one suspects that he very much did, he was now squarely positioned to succeed Robert Morris as America's preeminent financial figure. The few months that Hamilton spent trying to gather taxes demonstrated anew the perils of the Articles of Confederation. States regarded their payments to Congress, in effect, as voluntary and often siphoned off funds for local purposes before making any transfers. This situation, combined with a lack of independent federal revenues, had forced the Patriots to finance the Revolution by either borrowing or printing paper money. On July 4th, in his 6th Continentalist essay, Hamilton, with a nod to Morris, applauded the appointment of federal customs and tax collectors to create in the interior of each state a mass of influence in favor of the federal government. This essay makes clear that in the Revolution's waning days, Hamilton had to combat the utopian notion that America could dispense with taxes altogether. It is of importance to unmask this delusion and open the eyes of the people to the truth. It is paying too great a tribute to the idol of popularity to flatter so injurious and so visionary an expectation. In mid-July, while still cramming for his next bar exam, Hamilton traveled to Poughkeepsie and pleaded successfully with state legislatures to form a special committee to expedite tax collection. Working with Philip Schuyler, he got the legislature to adopt a set of resolutions, likely authored by Hamilton himself, calling for more congressional taxing power and a national conference to overhaul the Articles of Confederation, the first such appeal issued by a public body. Hamilton's determined pursuit of reform won plaudits from Morris, and in his correspondence with Hamilton, Morris let down his guard and confided his frustration at congressional ineptitude. Hamilton repaid the candor. The more I see, the more I find reason for those who love this country to weep over its blindness, Hamilton wrote. He recoiled at the cowardice and selfishness he saw rampant in the New York legislature. The inquiry constantly is what will please, not what will benefit the people, he told Morris. In such a government, there can be nothing but temporary expedient, fickleness, and folly. Increasingly, Hamilton despaired of pure democracy, of politicians simply catering to the popular will, and favored educated leaders who would enlighten the people and exercise their own judgment. Whatever his disdain for state legislators, Hamilton made a favorable impression at Poughkeepsie. Jurist James Kent recalled that his animated and didactic conversation, far superior to ordinary discourse in sentiment, language, and manner, and his frank and manly deportment, interested my attention. The legislators were so taken with Hamilton's presentation that he was chosen as one of five members of New York's delegation to the Continental, or Confederation, Congress that was to convene in November. With typical dexterity, Hamilton had parlayed the technocratic job of tax collector into a congressional seat. For Hamilton, nobody in his generation showed a more genuine love of country or more salient leadership traits than his friend John Laurens. In January 1782, at a time when the British still held Charleston and Savannah, Laurens had addressed the South Carolina legislature in a futile last bid for his star-crossed scheme to recruit black troops. That July, he wrote a warm letter to Hamilton, expressing hope that his friend would fill only the first offices of the Republic. Once again, a portion of Laurens's letter is missing, perhaps sanitized by Hamilton's family. The note concludes, "Adieu, my dear friend. While circumstances place so great a distance between us, I entreat you not to withdraw the consolation of your letters. You know the unalterable sentiments of your affectionate Laurens." Hamilton believed fervently that once the war ended, he and Laurens, like figures from classical antiquity, would embark jointly on a new political crusade to lay the foundations for a solid Republican Union. In mid-August, he told Laurens that the state legislature had named him to Congress. Striking an uplifting note, he made a stirring appeal for his old comrade to join him there. "Quit your sword, my friend. Put on the toga. Come to Congress. We know each other's sentiments. Our views are the same. We have fought side by side to make America free. Let us hand in hand struggle to make her happy." We do not know whether Laurens ever set eyes on this message. In late August 1782, a British expedition from Charleston was foraging for rice near the Cumbie River when the impetuous Laurens flouted orders and tried to ambush them with a small force. The enemy was tipped off and squatted in the high grass waiting for him. Once they stood up to fire, Laurens began to charge and exhorted his men to follow. He was instantly cut down by a bullet. John Laurens was one of the last casualties of the American Revolution. Many thought he had foolishly risked his life and those of his men in a trivial action against a superior force after real hostilities had ended. His death vindicated Washington's judgment that the patriotic Laurens had only one serious fault: intrepidity bordering on rashness. He was mourned by many who thought he had had the makings of a fine leader. "Our country has lost its most promising character in a manner, however, that was worthy of the cause," John Adams consoled Henry Laurens. For Hamilton, the news was crushing. "Poor Laurens, he has fallen a sacrifice to his ardor in a trifling skirmish in South Carolina," he wrote sadly to Lafayette, the other member of their war triumvirate. "You know how truly I loved him, and will judge how much I regret him." The death deprived Hamilton of the political peer, the steadfast colleague that he was to need in his tempestuous battles to consolidate the Union. He would enjoy a brief collaboration with James Madison and never lacked the stalwart, if often aloof, patronage of George Washington. But he was more of a solitary crusader without Laurens, lacking an intimate lifelong ally such as Madison and Jefferson found in each other. On a personal level, the loss was even more harrowing. Despite a large circle of admirers, Hamilton did not form deep friendships easily and never again revealed his interior life to another man as he had to Laurens. He became ever more voluble in his public life, but somehow less introspective and revelatory in private. Henceforth, his confessional remarks were reserved for Eliza or Angelica Church. After the death of John Laurens, Hamilton shut off some compartment of his emotions and never reopened it. In late November 1782, Alexander Hamilton, after trotting on horseback all the way from Albany, arrived in Philadelphia to take up his place in the Confederation Congress. The city of 40,000 people that he encountered was larger and more affluent than New York or Boston. Having grown up in seaside towns, he must have found something pleasingly familiar about this seaport with its tall masted ships and extensive wharves. Compared to the raucous commercial chaos of New York, Philadelphia was a more orderly place, abounding in elegant homes tucked discreetly behind garden walls. On sunny days, fashionable ladies strolled with parasols. Many tree-shaded streets had brick sidewalks swept clean by a sanitation department and illuminated nightly by whale oil lamps. The Presbyterians and Baptists now outnumbered Quakers, a trace of their old austerity lingered. By 11 p.m., one young English visitor grumbled, "There is no city in the world perhaps so quiet. At that hour, you may walk over half the town without seeing the face of a human being, except the watchman." Hamilton had left Eliza and baby Philip behind, but was still the starry-eyed newlywed and did not wander the streets in search of nocturnal adventure. He assured his wife several weeks after arriving that there never was a husband who could vie with yours in fidelity and affection. At first, he tolerated Eliza's absence well and did not yearn for her presence until early January, when he began arranging her trip to Philadelphia. Then he could not wait to see her. "Every hour in the day I feel a severe pang on this account, and half my nights are sleepless," he told her. "Come, my charmer, and relieve me. Bring my darling boy to my bosom." In Philadelphia, Hamilton found himself part of a Congress whose inadequacy he had long ridiculed. The whole jerry-built structure, the endless ad hoc committees, the voting rules that encouraged states to veto vital measures, the term limits that restricted congressmen to 3 1-year terms in a 6-year period, guaranteed paralysis. As Hamilton complained, the undemocratic voting rules put it in the power of a small combination to retard and even to frustrate the most necessary measures. For someone with his reverence for efficiency, it was an exasperating situation. The problems only worsened after November 30, 1782, when American peace commissioners signed a provisional peace treaty with Great Britain, sapping incentives for further unity. Local leaders such as Sam Adams in Massachusetts and Patrick Henry in Virginia eloquently asserted the sovereignty of the states. So magnetic was the allure of state governments that many members of Congress stayed home, making it difficult to muster quorums. The caliber of delegates suffered accordingly, and their jealous discords infuriated Hamilton. He was saved from despondency by a like-minded delegate who also foresaw a mighty nation and had a richly furnished mind to match his own, James Madison. They shared a continental perspective, enjoyed a congruent sense of missions, and served together on numerous committees. Having been thrown on his own resources at an early age, Hamilton, 27, was far more worldly than Madison, 31, who had led a cosseted life. On the other hand, Madison, laboring in Congress since 1780, was already a seasoned legislator. He was so conscientious that he set a congressional endurance record by scarcely missing a day during 3 years of service. The French minister rated Madison the man of soundest judgment in Congress. He speaks nearly always with fairness and wins the approval of his colleagues. In many ways, Madison was a pivotal figure in Hamilton's career, their early collaboration and later falling out, demarcating distinct stages in Hamilton's life. People tended either to embrace Hamilton or abhor him. Madison stands out for having alternated between the usual extremes. Small and shy, James Madison had a formidable mind, but he was unprepossessing in manner and appearance. He usually dressed in black, had the bookish pallor of a scholar, and cut a somber figure. Seldom did he smile in public, and the wife of one Virginia politician chided him as a gloomy, stiff creature. Another female observer found Madison entertaining in private, but mute, cold, and repulsive in company. He did not court publicity and lacked the charismatic sparkle that made the brashly confident Hamilton a natural leader. If Hamilton seemed born to rule, then Madison seemed born to reflect. Still, Madison's diffidence could be deceptive, and his indomitable force showed when he opened his mouth. He was a queer mixture of intellectual assurance, bordering on conceit, and social timidity and awkwardness. Lacking Hamilton's social ease and fluency, he could also be funny and a superb raconteur among warm companions, even telling the occasional bawdy tale. At the time they met, Madison was a priggish bachelor and tight-lipped about his private affairs. No personal gossip ever smudged the severe rectitude of James Madison's image. Madison came from a family that had lived comfortably in Virginia's Piedmont region for a century and was related to many local landowners. Madison's grandfather owned 29 slaves, and his father boosted that number to 118, making him the largest slaveholder in Orange County, Virginia. The family also owned up to 10,000 acres in the county. Until age 50, Madison, the oldest of 10 children, lived in economic dependence on his father and even in Congress fell back on income from the family plantation. Like Jefferson, he could not escape his dependence on slavery, whatever his private qualms, and told his father during his last year in Congress that unless the delegates got a pay raise, I shall be under the necessity of selling a Negro. Against an incongruous backdrop of black hands stooping in the fields, Madison passed his cloistered childhood. Suffering from a nervous disorder reminiscent of epilepsy, he was prone to hypochondria and, like many sickly children, took to reading. He received a fine classical education, 5 years at a boarding school, followed by 2 years of private tutoring on his plantation. At Princeton, he absorbed prodigious heaps of books and slept only 4 or 5 hours per night. President Witherspoon, who had rejected Hamilton, remarked of Madison that, during the whole time he was under my tuition, I never knew him to do or to say an improper thing. Madison retained the air of a perennial student and always immersed himself in laborious study before major political events. Because of poor health, Madison served only briefly as a colonel in the Orange County Militia and then became a member of the Virginia House of Delegates and the Governor's Council of State before being named the youngest member of Congress in 1780. Hamilton and Madison represented a new generation of post-war leaders whose careers were wholly identified with the new republic. At this juncture, they had a similar vision of the structural reforms needed by the government. Madison favored a standing army, a permanent navy, and other positions later associated with the Hamiltonians. If anything, Madison was even more militant than Hamilton in asserting central authority and wanted Congress to be able to apply force against states that refused to pay their requested contributions. Despite the thorny complexities, it was a heady time for these two young men who saw themselves striving for mankind. As Madison phrased it in April 1783, the rights for which America contended were the rights of human nature, and its citizens were responsible for the greatest trust ever confided to a political society. To galvanize the new country, Hamilton and Madison concentrated on the crying need for revenue, a need alleviated only partially when John Adams had arranged a large loan from Holland on June 11, 1782. They believed that Congress required a permanent, independent revenue source, free from reliance on the capricious whims of the states. Only then could Congress retire the huge war debt and stem a nascent movement to repudiate it. Hamilton stressed this in a resolution that read like a fervent trumpet blast. Resolved, that it is the opinion of Congress that complete justice cannot be done to the creditors of the United States, nor restoration of public credit be effected, nor the future exigencies of the war provided for, but by the establishment of permanent and adequate funds to operate generally throughout the United States, to be collected by Congress. Hamilton joined Madison in a campaign to introduce a federal impost, a 5% duty on all imports that would finally grant Congress autonomy in money matters. For Hamilton, the overriding goal was to institute a federal power of taxation. The most heated opposition came from Rhode Island, and Hamilton and Madison sat on a committee that dealt with the Maverick State. They issued a joint statement, almost entirely in Hamilton's handwriting, that reiterated his now standard plea of the importance of public credit to national honor. Then came a statement still more fraught with large consequences. The truth is that no federal constitution can exist without powers that, in their exercise, affect the internal policy of the component members. Hamilton was throwing down a gauntlet. The central government had to have the right to enact laws that superseded those of the states and to deal directly with their citizens. In late January, he made a still more heretical speech. He wanted to assign federal tax collectors to the states as a way of pervading and uniting them. Hamilton was now aiming openly not at a makeshift confederation of states, but at a unitary nation. Taken aback by this excessive candor, Madison noted that some members smiled at the disclosure and gloated privately that Mr. Hamilton had let out the secret. The incident again showed that Hamilton, far from being a crafty plotter, often could not muzzle his opinions. He was not one to traffic in half-hearted measures. Congress was setting enduring precedents for peacetime, and he opposed a compromise bill in April that limited the scope of the imposts and left revenue collection to each state. Hamilton's quarrel with New York Governor George Clinton over the impost was to blossom into full-blown mutual animosity and profoundly affect the rest of his career. Money was needed urgently to mollify the disaffected officers of the Continental Army, who threatened to turn mutinous at their winter camp in Newburgh, New York. The Provisional Peace Treaty raised the unsettling prospect that the Army might disband without officers receiving either back pay, as much as 6 years owed in some cases, or promised pensions. The officer corps buzzed with threats of mass resignations, and a three-man delegation went to Philadelphia to negotiate a solution. On January 6, 1783, they presented Congress with a petition that expressed festering grievances. "We have borne all that men can bear. Our property is expended. Our private resources are at an end." Some soldiers had been left so indebted by the fighting and the devalued currency that they feared they would be jailed upon their discharge from the army. Hamilton and Madison met with the disgruntled officers and were assigned to a subcommittee to devise a solution. The two men seized the chance to admonish Congress to fund the entire national war debt and satisfy the soldiers along with other creditors. The sad reality was that, deprived of real taxing power, Congress could offer the soldiers little but rhetorical solace. Hamilton held out slim hope that the states would replenish the general coffers and appease the officers' demands. With his pessimistic imagination, he dwelled on the dangers inherent in situations, and he feared that civil strife, even disunion, would follow peace with Britain. In mid-February, he wrote apprehensively to Governor Clinton, outlining a plan to resettle military officers in New York State. "I wish the legislature would set apart a tract of territory and make a liberal allowance to every officer and soldier of the army at large who will become a citizen of the state." As a leading Continentalist, Hamilton knew that such a suggestion might seem to counter his image. "It is the first wish of my heart that the Union may last," he explained. "But feeble as the links are, what prudent man would rely upon it? Should a disunion take place, any person who will cast his eyes upon the map will see how essential it is to our state to provide for its own security." In this case, Clinton heeded Hamilton's advice and handed out lucrative land grants in New York State to willing officers. Hamilton knew that the final arbiter of the deadly stalemate between restive officers and an impotent Congress was George Washington, with whom he had not corresponded in more than a year. On February 13th, presuming on their former trust, Hamilton addressed a confidential letter to him. Writing now as a peer, he dared to advise Washington on how to handle the threatened uprising. For Hamilton, such a threat had its uses if it could prod a lethargic Congress into bolstering national finances. "The claims of the army, urged with moderation but with firmness, may operate on those weak minds which are influenced by their apprehensions more than their judgments. But the difficulty will be to keep a complaining and suffering army within the bounds of moderation." For Washington to maintain his standing among both the army and the citizenry at large, Hamilton urged him to badger Congress through surrogates. Hamilton was coaxing Washington to dabble in a dangerous game of pretending to be a lofty statesman while covertly orchestrating pressure on Congress. The letter shows Hamilton at his most devious, playing with combustible forces. He wasn't alone in this strategy. Governor Morris in Philadelphia was also writing to General Nathanael Greene that the states would never pay the army unless the army be united and determined in the pursuit of it. Hamilton feared that the cautious Washington might be thrust aside by more militant officers and told him of whispering in the army that he did not uphold his soldiers' interests with sufficient warmth. "The falsehood of this opinion no one can be better acquainted with than myself, but it is not the less mischievous for being false." A week later, Hamilton and Madison met at the home of Thomas Fitzsimons to discuss the growing officer militants. Madison's notes give us Hamilton's unexpurgated view of Washington at the time. It jibes with his earlier statements about Washington's sometimes irritable personality, but absolute rectitude. Mr. Hamilton said that he knew General Washington intimately and perfectly, that his extreme reserve, mixed sometimes with a degree of asperity of temper, both of which were said to have increased of late, had contributed to the decline of his popularity, but that his virtue, his patriotism, and his firmness would never yield to any dishonorable plans into which he might be called, that he would sooner suffer himself to be cut into pieces, that he, Mr. Hamilton, knowing this to be his true character, wished him to be the conductor of the army in their plans for redress in order that they might be moderated and directed to proper objects. On March 4th, Washington thanked Hamilton for his frank letter and confessed that he had not fathomed the abysmal state of America's finances. End of Disc 7.